This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Over the past few weeks, while attention focused on the bloody battles between U.S. forces and Shia rebels in Najaf and other cities in southern Iraq, Sunni fundamentalist militias have consolidated their power in the western cities of Fallujah and Ramadi. In just a moment, we'll speak with New York Times correspondent John Burns about the consequences of last spring's decision to suspend a military offensive in Fallujah. Afterwards, we'll talk with Larry Diamond, who served as senior advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, about his article in Foreign Affairs magazine, What Went Wrong in Iraq? Among other failures of planning and policy, Diamond cites military indecision. But he also says the CPA did some things right and that a democratic Iraq may yet emerge. Later in the program, we'll go to New York for an update on the Republican National Convention with NPR political editor Ken Rudin, and comedian Lewis Black will join us again to turn his jaundiced eye on the proceedings in and around Madison Square Garden. But first, Iraq. As I mentioned, we'll be talking first about Fallujah and the Sunni Triangle, then about U.S. policy during the war and the occupation and prospects for democracy. If you have questions, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now by phone from Baghdad is John Burns, correspondent for the New York Times. And thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
We have to begin with the news, and that starts with the awful pictures we saw released from Iraq today by a group that executed 12 Nepalese. Tell us what happened there.
Well, it more or less doubles at a stroke the number of people who have been executed by these Islamic militants in the Sunni Triangle area, principally at Fallujah. And it seems that the news from there only gets worse. It's a problem that, for the moment, the United States has no answer to. It's a problem that is going to have to be solved if, in my view, Iraq is, in fact, a progress towards any kind of representative democratic government.
In the meantime, there is still no word on the fate of two French reporters who are also being held. There are some negotiations underway and at least some encouraging signs.
Yeah, I think the signs are encouraging. And I think within a matter of hours, and possibly less than that, we will hear about those things. We've been hearing, perhaps a little prematurely, we've been hearing some very encouraging things about that. But how to offset that against the execution of the Nepalese who come from a country which is not part of the coalition? And this kind of brutality has been getting worse. And I think you'd have to say that whether there were links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, whether there was in fact a war on terror to be fought here in 2003, there certainly is now. And, of course, the American voters will decide who is in the main responsible for that. But right now, the United States is faced with a concentration and an increasing concentration of Islamic militants who either are linked to al-Qaeda or certainly share a common view with al-Qaeda and a common lexicon with al-Qaeda and a common brutality with al-Qaeda. And they're only 30 miles west of Baghdad.
Well, take us back a couple of months to the spring. The United States Marines launched an offensive in Anbar province, where the cities of Fallujah and Ramadi are located, western Iraq, west of Baghdad, and then stopped halfway through the city of Fallujah.
It's true. The 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, which took over from the 82nd Airborne Division, the responsibility for Anbar province, which is a more or less triangular wedge-shaped province that runs west from Baghdad to the borders of Syria, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, a crucially strategic province with a population of some 2.5 million people centered on Fallujah and Ramadi. The Marines decided, under some provocation, that they were going to take control of Fallujah. They were, as by their accounts, fairly close to that. Some officers said within 48 hours of it, when they were ordered to pull back because the political costs of their operation were mounting. Probably several hundred people in Fallujah had died. And the decision was made in Washington and Baghdad that the price was too high and to go for a compromise solution, which involved putting into Fallujah the Fallujah Brigade. Basically, if I can put it as simplest, the idea was that old Saddam Hussein loyalists who were prepared to work with the United States would be put into Fallujah and Ramadi in various government positions, and that they would bring those cities under control and eliminate the terrorists. Well, it didn't happen. In fact, the opposite happened. The Islamic militants took control. Those Saddam loyalists who had turned to the United States, who were not humiliated and forced into resignation or executed, fled. And the two cities are, as much as we can tell now, in the hands of the Islamic militants.
The report in the New York Times over the weekend, you described the Fallujah as almost a Taliban-like situation.
I think that's correct. I think it is, and it's clear from talking to people at the head of the American military command here and at the United States Embassy at a level of authority that a decision in principle has been taken to deal with this in time. It looks like the stratagem is to wait until the new American-trained Iraqi army, the Iraqi National Guard and the police are sufficiently trained up and are sufficiently numerous to be able to undertake an offensive, principally in Fallujah, but also in Ramadi. There's a general recognition that this is not going to be soon, and it may not be before the national elections that are due by the 31st of January, and it may therefore be that Anbar province, at least in its principal cities, will have to be written off from those elections, and that will be a major problem because it accounts as one of the four problems, one of the four provinces of the Sunni Triangle. But it's absolutely crucial. It is the heartland of Saddam's support. And an election without Anbar province will be, to say the least, an imperfect election.
John Burns, thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
John Burns, a correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with us on the phone from Baghdad. We apologize for the poor quality of the transmission from Baghdad. As you listeners to this program know, you have to take your chances with the quality of phone lines you can get. Joining us now is Larry Diamond. He served as senior advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq. He recently wrote an article for Foreign Affairs magazine titled What Went Wrong in Iraq, and he joins us now on the line from Stanford University. And thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I don't know if you were able to, how much you were able to hear from John Burns there in Baghdad, but at the end of that conversation, he was saying that it may not be possible for Anbar province to be included in the upcoming Iraqi elections that are scheduled to take place no later than January. This is one of a number of problems facing those elections, as you describe it in your article.
Oh, yes. Let's start with this one. First of all, John Burns and Eric Ekholm wrote one of the most brilliant and chilling pieces on the post-war situation in Iraq that I've read since fighting ended in early April of last year. It's a very, very important and deeply disturbing piece about the growth of radical Islamic fundamentalist, as you said a few minutes ago, Taliban-style sentiment and organization in a crucially important part of Iraq, and it demonstrates that we now have a situation in Iraq that we did not have before the war, one in which al-Qaeda, in the form of al-Zarqawi and his elements, or other jihadist, extreme Islamic fundamentalist, anti-democratic, anti-Western civilization elements have taken a deep hold and have a haven in part of Iraq. Certainly you can't conduct elections in that kind of context, and I worry about the implications for security more widely in the country.
And John Burns was telling us that, in his opinion, that at the moment the plan is to await the training up of Iraqi mm-hmm. forces before attempting perhaps another military, attempt to solve this by military means. Political means have thus far failed. Is a military assault finally going to be the only solution, do you think?
I think it was not the only solution in terms of dealing with Muqtada al-Sadr, and we'll come to that. And you can see that we've had possibly a breakthrough now as a result of Ayatollah al-Sistani's intervention. But in dealing with these Islamist, radical, Al-Qaeda, Taliban-style insurgents in Al-Anbar province, I think that the only way to defeat them is to crush them and defeat them. There's no talking to them. There's no reasoning with them. I think it's going to be very hard for the United States to do that. I think the judgment that has been made now by American military and political officials is the right one, and that we have to throw everything we have into training, organizing, equipping, recruiting, and effectively standing up all of the different branches of the Iraqi armed services so that they can receive the challenge of providing order and security in the country and receive the mission of facing down these obvious implacable foes of any kind of decent order in the future Iraq. And it's going to be a long time, but I do want to emphasize that one of the reasons we are in this miserable situation today was because of the failure of the Bush administration to prepare for the post-war era, the failure to put in enough troops, the failure to seal the borders, the failure to prevent this jihadist takeover of these cities. It was preventable, and I think it was extreme negligence on the part of this administration, as I say in my foreign affairs article, that allowed this to happen.
One more question on this before we move on to some of the other important questions. Last spring, that military offensive by the Marines was halted halfway through Fallujah because the judgment was made the political price would be too high. The political price will be just as high whenever a military operation goes through Fallujah.
I don't quite agree, Neil. I think that if it is done by Iraqi armed forces, and if it is done by a broadly based and democratically elected government, I think the reaction in Iraq is going to be far different. And I think in particular that an elected government with some legitimacy and base of support in the country is going to be much more able to say these people are vicious thugs. Our country has been taken over by foreigners who have terrorized some of our cities and at least in particular one of our provinces, and we have to take our country back. The United States can't say that. It's even hard for an appointed Iraqi interim government to say that, but I think a democratically elected government could say that.
Mm-hmm. The apparent political deal with Muqtada al-Sadr is at least in part based on the perception that come elections, the Shias, he's a Shia cleric, will get the majority of the power. They are the majority of the population. The Sunnis in western Iraq fear that their long hold, their long monopoly on power, they're about 20% of the population, that they have no stake in democracy.
Well, the Sunnis are very divided. Keep in mind that there are very important Sunni political figures in this interim government, including the Minister of Interior, Falah Najib, who's a very impressive man. And a lot of the Sunnis have come into the political game, have organized political parties, have loosely associated in a kind of broad network, and the Sunnis are divided. In Saddam's home area of Tikrit, actually, we see much more cooperation than resistance, playing of the political game. So I think that when elections proceed and then a permanent constitution is drafted that provides for devolution of power and sharing of power so that no one group is going to dominate any time in the future. And when the Sunnis see, when the Kurds see, when all Iraqis see that Shias are not of one voice, that will make a very big difference.
We're talking with Larry Diamond, now a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. We'll have more after a short break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about what went wrong in Iraq with Larry Diamond. He's the author of an article by that name in Foreign Affairs magazine, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and served as a senior advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is totn@npr.org. And let's go to the phones. And Ken joins us from Sonora, California.
Hello?
Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Great. My question was, when are we going to admit that we cannot bring a Western-style democracy to Iraq? When are we going to admit that these people have views that are very, very different from ours? And when are we going to exit their country and allow them to live their life in the way that it works out for them?
Larry Diamond?
Okay. On the first part of Ken's question, I think that we can't bring democracy of our own will and force to any country in the world. And it may be that what will emerge in Iraq is not a Western-style democracy, but an Iraqi-style democracy that is nevertheless still democratic. But I think that type of question, which I have heard often, underestimates the degree to which ordinary Iraqis aspire to live in a country with a rule of law, protections for personal freedom, and the ability to choose and replace their leaders. And that basically amounts to democracy, whether you call it Western style or whatever it is. And I think it's somewhat unfair and maybe culturally biased to say that Iraqis don't value democracy, they don't value freedom, they're happy living under some kind of strong man. Let's just leave them to it. When are we going to leave? I don't know, but I've been very clear in saying that I think we need to have an exit strategy. I think we need to define it more clearly. And I think the essential criterion of it is that we need to put everything we have, as I've said, break through every bureaucratic contracting hurdle to train, equip, recruit, help organize the Iraqi armed forces. When they are of sufficient number, quality, discipline, and character to tackle the challenge of asserting the authority of the new democratic Iraqi state internally and defending the country from external aggression and subversion, we should leave. We should leave completely, and we should declare that we do not have long-term military aspirations in the country.
Well, I take odds with the fact that it was culturally biased. I want to make the point that if the Iraqi people had the opportunity to vote and they voted in Muqtada al-Sadr as the leader of their country, I don't believe that the United States government would allow that to stand. Or if they revoted Saddam back into office, they will not. I want them to simply have their own self-determination, and I don't believe that our actions are leading them to making free choices, but choices that are swayed to our best benefit. And thank you for taking my call.
Ken, we appreciate the call. You do write in your article, Larry Diamond, at several points of the danger of Islamic fundamentalists winning an election.
I don't think that Muqtada al-Sadr is going to win this election. I think he has a passionate following among some young, urban, dispossessed, unemployed Shiites. A political party that he leads or sanctions might get, I think, 10 to 20% of the Shia vote, which means probably not more than 10% of the total vote. So Muqtada al-Sadr is not coming to power in Iraq. There are more moderate Islamist parties, so the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, Dawah, the Islamic Call Party. It's possible to imagine that some coalition of Islamist parties could take power. But I think if there are free and fair elections, or anything close to it, anything approaching it, there's going to be a wide dispersion of the vote, and no party is going to have anything close to a majority. There's going to be a coalition government. And frankly, a moderately Islamist government in Iraq might not be what we want, and it could be partly hostile to the United States. But compared to the alternatives we're looking at, it wouldn't be the disaster that civil war would be, for example, or the descent of Iraq into a Lebanon-style or Afghan-style parceling out of radical fiefdoms by different warlords. So I think we have to let the process take its course. And if there's an election and a leader comes to power that we don't like, frankly, at that point, I don't think there's very much that the United States is going to be able to do about it. What are we going to do, invade all over again to topple that government?
Let's get a call from Chuck in San Francisco.
Hi, thank you very much.
Sure.
Well, first of all, I was a little bit young at the time, but the talk about the training up of the Iraqi military makes me feel a little bit uneasy about the old Vietnamization concept. But I'm wondering about the state of politics in Iraq now and at the time of the election when that happens. Are there parties that are sufficiently well known that the people in Iraq are actually going to have candidates that they know something about in order to cast an informed vote? And especially I'm wondering about the role of the interim government. I wonder if they, just by virtue of the fact that they're in place and people will have some familiarity with them, are they going to be big players in the election? And if so, is their connection to us going to throw them into, going to make their legitimacy an issue?
All good questions. Let me move in reverse. With respect to the interim government, it does contain four political parties that have clear and, I'd say, fairly resilient political bases among at least parts of the country. These are the two Kurdish parties, the KDP and the PUK in the north, which probably can command the support of, some people estimate, at least half of the Kurdish vote collectively, maybe more. And the two Islamist Shia parties in the south, Skiri and Dawa. I don't think these parties are going to be greatly hurt by having been associated with the United States in the governing council during the occupation and now in the interim government. I think the reverse is true, that, as the questioner implies, that other political parties are not well known. They have not had a chance to organize. They're very weakly funded. And one of the concerns that people had about rushing to elections was that other political parties representing new, more independent, more creative coming together of different elements of Iraqi society, professionals, farmers, and so on, different tribal groups perhaps coming together, they need time to organize to build their constituencies. I might add they also need financial resources. Iran, Saudi Arabia have been pouring in huge amounts of money to their favored religious parties, and the international community needs to find a way between now and the voting, which is probably going to come next January, needs to find a way to provide transparently and fairly some minimum floor of funding to other political parties.
And the party, briefly, go ahead, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
Well, just briefly to conclude about Vietnamization, I followed the war closely as someone who was opposed to the Vietnam War. I think that was a failing enterprise in almost every respect. I think we need to be careful about analogies between Vietnam and Iraq. I think the people of Iraq feel a much stronger stake in their emerging democracy than the Vietnamese people felt in their phony and failing regime that we were supporting.
Could I just interject for a moment?
Yeah, go ahead.
You say that the association with us is not going to taint the candidates that are have participated in the interim government, but I'd love it if you could expand on that as to why that's so.
Well, in the north, the Kurds have enjoyed autonomy, based defended by the United States, ever since the first Gulf War. Their association with the Americans is, one would think, would be something of an advantage in the Kurdish voters.
Okay, how about the rest of them?
Okay, what Neil said is true about the North, and their base of support is very reliable and solid. Keep in mind that some of the parties that were in the governing council, now in the interim government, have also been critical of the United States. Ibrahim Jaafari, who's one of the two vice presidents of the country and the leader of the Dawa party, has hardly been a tool and a patsy of the United States. So he has a base of support and, in fact, could emerge as the single most popular politician in the country over the coming months. I think some of them will suffer. Alawi may suffer. It remains to be seen. But where political parties have strong established bases of support, I think they're going to prove to be fairly resilient. And my concern is simply to enable as level a playing field as possible so that other new alternative political parties have a chance to mobilize and campaign for support.
Chuck, thank you.
Thank you.
One of the characters in your article, I think you probably reserved some of your more acid remarks for Ahmed Chalabi, the expatriate Iraqi with whom the United States was, the Pentagon at least, was closely allied before the war. Has he played himself out of power at this point?
I doubt it. And the reason why I doubt it is because he is a brilliant and indefatigable political tactician. And he's gone back to Iraq despite these legal charges leveled against him. And he's a very clever political player. So I don't think you can ever count Ahmed Chalabi out. But he is not popular in Iraq. He has very little political support. Polls were showing a few months ago that, in fact, he was the single most distrusted politician in the country. More distrusted, although people may not have volunteered the name very much because they weren't thinking of him in that context, but more distrusted than Saddam Hussein. So I think that Chalabi is never going to fulfill his aspiration to become the leader of Iraq, the prime minister and whatnot. But he could become a significant political player, and he will be a member of this 100-member interim council.
Let's talk now with Skip. Skip's on the line from Kansas City.
Is it Larry?
Yes, Larry.
Hi, Larry. I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to read your article. Mm-hmm. How old are you?
53.
Then you probably do remember the taking of Mecca during the 80s, early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Yeah, yes, he said he did.
And your point is?
Well, my point is if that type of situation could take place in Saudi Arabia with the tight controls that those people have on their people, and with the army that they have and as well equipped an army as they have, they still had to call for outside help to resolve the situation. And I'm wondering, wasn't that a learning lesson for this country as far as, you know, what we needed to do before we went into Iraq? You know, back in that period of time, we had installed Saddam Hussein as a buffer between Iran and the rest of the Middle East. And how did we lose such a control that we exerted mm-hmm. in that period of time?
How did we wind up in this situation?
Yeah. What's that?
How did we wind up in this situation, I think, is what a lot of Americans are asking.
I think had I been in charge of doing something about the despicable situation we had in Iraq, I think I'd have gone over enough manpower to completely disarm the whole country. But when you do that, now you destabilize the area, and I'm not sure that we wanted to. And, you know, I have questions about whether we're in exactly the position we want to be in, you know,
We certainly are not. Let me try to answer your question. I think you've put your finger on an enormously important point, Skip, which is that we did not go in with enough troops to secure post-war Iraq. We had enough troops to win the war, faster apparently than President Bush was expecting, but we didn't have nearly enough troops to secure the peace. This is a point I emphasize over and over again in my foreign affairs article. And we did not have the rules of engagement and the mentality that was necessary to really establish authority and secure the country in the immediate post-war aftermath, which is why there was all the looting and insecurity that took place. And Iraqis immediately lost confidence in us, and insurgents became emboldened. So now we have the situation of, I think, acute insecurity and really virtual civil war that we see in certain parts of the country. It's a tragedy, and I think the lesson we have to learn from this is to be a little bit more realistic in our expectations and a little bit less hubristic in expecting that simply because we view ourselves as having a moral and noble purpose, that we're going to be welcomed in that way by other people who, after all, are having their country invaded by foreign forces.
We're talking with Larry Diamond. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And as we look at the past and the numbers of mistakes, U.S. policy, you say, is replete, hubristic, indecisive at very important times, ideological, all kinds of problems with American policy. Yet you say there's really no alternative except to move ahead with the best democratization that we can.
There's no alternative now. I didn't favor going to war in the first place, although I did believe that it was a close call. I think now, you know, if we just walk away, Neil, this place is going to fall into a civil war, and much more of the country is going to look like Fallujah and Ramadi, as described by John Burns. So I think this is simply unacceptable. I do think that there is, as I said, a strong aspiration among a large proportion of the Iraqi population to have some kind of decent, democratic, lawful government. And I think that if we can help to improve the security context, at least in much of the country, and keep investing in the political processes of preparation for elections and assistance to Iraqi civil society organizations, political parties, and the interim government, and that they can then get to this elected transitional government, which they so badly want, I think the political situation in the country will be better. People will rally around the transitional political structures much more readily. They'll have more legitimacy. While we keep building up the Iraqi armed forces, training them, enlarging them, and so on, and then that combination of growing political legitimacy and increasing security capacity will enable us to begin to withdraw, because our troops are not only a bulwark for security to some extent now, they are also a stimulus to insecurity at the same time. And I think that the insurgency will have some of its steam seriously taken out of it when American troops are gone.
I've left a very important question and only 10 seconds for you to answer it. Is the worst over?
No, I don't think so. We're in for a long, difficult couple of years.
Larry Diamond, thank you so much.
Thank you, Neil.
Larry Diamond is the author of What Went Wrong in Iraq. It's in the 2004 October issue of Foreign Affairs. He joined us from Stanford University, where he's a senior fellow. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.